Chapter 17. The Plan. Abstaining from starches, grains, and sugars, and replacing them with fat, takes practice, preparation, and ideally, the help of a good doctor. I'd like to be able to give a detailed, very specific recipe for how to more or less rigidly abstain from starches, grains, and sugar, and keep it up for life. A series of steps that guarantee success, ideally tried and true for everyone. But no such thing exists. We all have much in common, but we start from different baselines, different culinary cultures and family practices, and we have different needs. Each of us will have to pull different levers. The basics are clear, what foods not to eat, but the details will vary. Keep in mind that the goal is not to think of this as following some specific diet, i.e. doing LCHF or keto or paleo or some other variation, but understanding how to eat so that you can correct your weight and health by working with your physiology, not fighting it. The advantage we have today is that LCHF ketogenic eating is no longer a fringe endeavor. The orthodox may still think of it as a dangerous fad diet, but it's catching on because it works. It's become so common that LCHF ketogenic foods, cauliflower rice, zucchini noodles, are now widely available in markets, in restaurants, and from online distributors. Keto-friendly processed foods are also becoming ever more widely available. Shakes, candy bars, snacks that are paleo and vegan-friendly as well. Although, I'm less sanguine about the benefits of consuming them regularly. The internet, in all its manifestations, has made it effortless to obtain information, recipes, and advice, some reliable, some less so. Thinking about LCHF ketogenic eating, abstaining from carbohydrates and replacing those calories with fat, divides up conveniently into five ideally essential elements. For many of you, these LCHF ketogenic eating concepts will be intuitively obvious, and the process of changing how you eat will be easy. You'll feel better. You'll have faith you're doing the right thing and can keep it up for life, a long and fulfilling one. For those who need more guidance, here are the keys. 1. Guidance. Finding a physician with whom you can work. Abstaining from carbohydrate-rich foods and beverages and transitioning to LCHF ketogenic eating literally changes the energy source on which your body runs, from mostly carbohydrates to mostly fat. This is not a minor transformation. You are quite literally changing how your body fuels itself, and it helps to do this with the guidance of an informed medical professional. With luck, this process will be easy, but there's no guarantee. The odds, though, are very good that your physician is still thinking about obesity and fat accumulation and their relationship to the chronic diseases that associate with them along conventional lines. So it's best to find a physician who is well-informed about LCHF ketogenic eating, or who is at least open-minded and willing to do the necessary homework. You may be on medications for blood sugar and blood pressure specifically, that will have to be discontinued or decreased once you have changed your diet. If this is the case, you certainly need a physician to help. He or she can do preliminary blood tests and a thorough checkup, not just monitoring LDL cholesterol, but making all the assessments related to insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and your other health issues. If you're depressive, or your hair is falling out, or you have eczema, or even toe fungus, it would help to have that documented in advance so you will be aware of everything that might change with this change of eating. A careful checkup can give you and the physician benchmarks from which to measure your progress. You can Google keto or LCHF physicians near me and see what comes up. Or you can go to sites hosted, for instance, by dietdoctor.com, lowcarbusa.org, or lowcarbdoctors.blogspot.com to get started. If you cannot find a sympathetic physician or dietitian, one possibility is to use a program like that offered by Virta Health so that you will at least have an informed physician handy on the other end of a telephone. 2. Goals. Establishing reasonable objectives. Setting a reasonable goal is a necessity for any successful project. If you're going to change how you eat for a lifetime, identifying your goal in advance will make it easier. What are you working for and why? Keep in mind that this is a lifetime pursuit, so your goals have to be realistic. Losing weight and getting healthy aren't perfectly correlated with happiness, for instance. They should help, but they will not be sufficient. For those who have type 2 diabetes, controlling the disease with minimal or even no medications might be a worthwhile goal, even without significant weight loss. Not having to manage a chronic disease with all the medications and attendant costs, both human and financial, or at least making disease management as easy as possible, should be very much worth a lifetime of abstaining from donuts, bagels, and beer. In his 1962 memoir, Strong Medicine, the New York cardiologist and LCHF ketogenic eating advocate Blake Donaldson put this in his typically forthright manner. "You are out of your mind," he wrote, "when you take insulin in order to eat Danish pastry." You have to establish in advance a minimum amount of time you will commit wholeheartedly to this new way of eating. You have to believe that what you're giving up is worth what you're gaining back in health and perhaps weight loss. A few weeks are not enough, just as they're not enough to know whether quitting smoking or alcohol is worth the effort. I would say 3 months is a minimum, ideally 6, long enough to get a realistic feel for what is possible. Without clinical trials to tell us about its long-term risks and benefits, the best you can do is give it a try and see what happens. My favorite statement to this effect comes from the British Columbia physician Martin Andre. He says that he tells his patients to embrace it for at least a month, ideally a few. If this is bad for you, it's not going to harm you in a month or two. If you don't eat potato chips for a few months, you're not going to die from it. And if there are no disease benefits after that time, then stop if you want. But I've never had people come back and say, "I feel worse." I am now confident in this dietary change that everyone will benefit. One guarantee can be given, though. If one day you determine it's not worth it, and you go back to eating sugars, grains, and starches, the benefits you accrued will be lost. A lifetime of benefit will come only from a lifetime commitment. 3. Abstinence. How best to begin will depend on what you decided were your goals and objectives. If you were going to treat the carbohydrate-rich foods you eat as an addiction, which is reasonable for many of us, then there are multiple ways to quit. In 2014, for instance, when I realized my caffeine addiction had become counterproductive, I decided it was time to end it. I could have gone cold turkey, but I didn't feel I could deal with the symptoms of caffeine withdrawal, not just the headaches, but the fatigue and mental fog that would persist until my brain and body relearned how to generate the necessary mental clarity without caffeine. So I weaned myself off slowly. A pound of coffee beans typically lasted me a week and a half. I bought 10 pounds in 10 bags, and I had the local barista mix them so that the bag we labeled number one had 90% caffeinated coffee and 10% decaf. Bag number two was 80-20, and so on until bag 10, which was all decaf. I went through bags 1 through 10 in order, and it worked. I functioned smoothly throughout the transition, and by the time it was finished, I could get through a day caffeine-free without cravings. It wasn't all sunshine and roses, but it worked. I had taken a recovery-slash-corrective process that might have required only a few difficult weeks and stretched it out to 3.5 easier months. Which is better? I'll never know. I did what worked for me. While the physicians and dietitians I interviewed tended to prefer the cold turkey method of carbohydrate abstinence, they were not adamant. Many said they make the decision about what to advocate to their patients or clients based largely on their assessment of what they think those patients or clients can handle emotionally and psychologically. Can they easily embrace the necessity and concept of LCHF ketogenic eating? If you want to shift to this new way of eating slowly, a step at a time, the obvious first step is to start with an essential requirement for any rational approach to weight loss, weight control, and healthy eating, regardless of the belief system. Stop eating and drinking sugar. This includes fruit juices, sports drinks, and such purported health drinks as kombucha, kefir, iced tea, and vitamin water if they are sweetened with sugar. The physicians and dietitians I interviewed will also phrase this recommendation as stop drinking your calories, which also means no alcoholic beverages and no milk, whether dairy, almond, soy, or otherwise. By saying this is an obvious first step, I don't mean to imply that it is necessarily an easy one. But its degree of difficulty suggests the strength of your addiction to these sugary beverages and the caffeine or alcohol that may go with them. All the more reason to break the addiction. All these sugary beverages are fuel sources for the body that we tend to consume between meals. They will stimulate insulin secretion, and we will burn the carbohydrates or alcohol in these beverages for energy during periods when we should, ideally, be burning fat mobilized from our fat cells. This step alone, no liquid calories, should improve insulin resistance, body composition, and perhaps energy level and mood as well. It's hard to imagine the physician and dietitian, regardless of belief system, who would not applaud and support taking this step. One physician I interviewed, who commonly recommends that his patients wean off carbohydrates step by step, is William Curtis, a family physician in Corpus Christi, Texas. As Curtis told me, Corpus Christi has among the highest obesity and diabetes rates in his state, and so it's not surprising that many of his patients suffer from these disorders. Curtis was introduced to LCHF ketogenic eating by a chiropractor friend who invited him to hear a lecture about it, which led him to attend an entire conference on the subject, and eventually he was sold. He was fascinated by the idea that multiple medical problems could be treated by nutrition alone. "I went in thinking this was quackery," he said. "But the more I listened and the more I tried it, the better the results I got. For example, I had patients who had gastric reflux and told me they'd had it forever. Once I got them to start cutting grains and sugar, they didn't have it anymore. I had diabetics who stopped eating starches and sugars, and their hemoglobin A1C went from 15, severely diabetic, down to under 6, a healthy level of blood sugar control, in 3 months. How does that happen? There's no medicine that can do that." So I went down the rabbit hole. Now, Curtis starts his patients with what he calls the 80-20 principle. 20% of what we eat constitutes 80% of the problem. The 20% with his patients are sodas, sweet tea, fruit juice, and beer. "I probably gave that talk 12 times today," he said when I interviewed him in July 2017. They say, "What about this? What about that?" And I say, "Just don't drink sodas, tea, fruit juice, and beer, and do that alone, and come back to see me in 3 weeks." I had one lady who lost 9 pounds in 3 weeks just because she stopped drinking the 2 Dr. Peppers she was drinking every day. Once a patient sees how much better they feel without the constant flow of liquid carbs and sugars, he gets more assertive. You have to tell people, just don't do this anymore. It's not maybe, it's not sometimes, you just don't do it. And you hold them accountable. You relate to them and tell them you stopped this. You notice how you feel now? You did this. You caused this by your choice. You fueled your body differently and it behaved differently. Do you like that? Yes? Then walk with me and we're going to do some more things. Another approach to the weaning process is to remove the starches, grains, and sugars one meal at a time. In this case, breakfast is key. A phrase I heard more than once in my interviews is that the typical carbohydrate-rich breakfast, cereal, toast with or without jam, juice, low-fat milk, sweetened low-fat yogurt, will have you and your pancreas chasing your blood sugar all day long, driving moods, energy levels, and hunger for carbohydrate-rich snacks. Switch to a breakfast of protein and mostly fat, whether eggs and bacon or smoked salmon and avocado or some other combination, and your insulin and blood sugar will both remain low, allowing you to metabolize your own fat as you've been doing through the night and into the morning. You should be surprised at how satisfied you remain through the morning and well into early afternoon. Once you've altered your breakfast routine and accepted that the benefits are worth what you're giving up, you can move to lunch, dinner, and snacks. That should all be relatively easy. For many, if not most of us, though, this easy part is postponing the inevitable. It also delays the greater benefits and specifically the significant weight loss. Establishment experts often ridiculed Atkins for saying that ketosis is better than sex. But there's a lot to be said for the energy that people experience when they are freely mobilizing fat and burning it for fuel. Until you try abstaining from sugars, starches, and grains entirely, going cold turkey, you won't know how easy it might be for you. At the end of the day, Laura Reardon, a Halifax physician and former world-class triathlete, told me, you want your patients to have a lifestyle that's sustainable, but you also want them to experience that paradigm shift, that, okay, so this is what health feels like. That way you're giving them both the tools and the motivation to carry on forever. 4. Contingencies. Do this right and expect the unexpected. Any successful endeavor requires that you expect and be prepared for adverse circumstances. In this case, you want to preempt, if possible, or at least minimize the adverse symptoms of carbohydrate withdrawal that might derail your progress or seem like a reason to quit. When physicians and researchers talk about a well-formulated LCHF ketogenic diet, a concept popularized by Steve Finney, Jeff Volek, and their company, Virta Health, they mean one that will minimize side effects while maximizing benefits. If you're going to switch to LCHF ketogenic eating, you want to make sure you do it right. The transition from burning mostly carbohydrates to burning fat has physiological effects beyond mobilizing fat from your fat cells and stimulating ketone production. Historically, the orthodox authorities have wielded any adverse side effects as reasons to avoid LCHF ketogenic eating, but they're mostly symptoms of the withdrawal process. These symptoms are no more a reason to go back to eating sugars, starches, and grains than delirium tremens would be a reason for an alcoholic to go back to drinking. Only a minority appear to suffer from them, but preparing for the eventuality and understanding the mechanisms will help you weather the storm if you do. As a physician would want you to know what to expect from any drug they might be prescribing and what to do to minimize side effects, for example, take the pill on a full stomach, the same is true with embracing LCHF ketogenic eating. The most common side effect is what used to be known as the Atkins flu, now typically known as the keto flu. As I said earlier, when you lower insulin, your kidneys will excrete sodium, salt, in urine rather than retain it. This goes along with several pounds of water that's no longer bound up with glucose in its storage form, glycogen. This water weight is lost at the beginning of any diet, whether calorie-restricted or carbohydrate-restricted, but it's more extreme in LCHF ketogenic eating. The absence of carbohydrates means the glycogen stores are more quickly depleted. The combination of water loss and sodium loss appears to be a major cause of most of these flu-like symptoms, perhaps all of them, including headache, fatigue, nausea, lightheadedness, and constipation. At its worst, the keto flu can be debilitating. Barbara Buten, a gynecological oncologist in suburban Chicago, told me that the first time she tried LCHF ketogenic eating, she quickly quit because of the keto flu. "I couldn't sustain it," she said, "because I couldn't function at surgery. Then I tried again a few months later, and I made it through. The second time, it was like a couple of days without coffee." Other physicians said some of their patients felt like crap for a few days to a few weeks while their bodies adapt to mobilizing fat and using it for fuel. There are no hard numbers on the likelihood that you'll feel these withdrawal symptoms. Some physicians I interviewed said these symptoms were common among their patients. Some said they were uncommon. I can't quite put my finger on the rhyme or reason behind why some feel it worse than others. Kelly Clark, a nurse practitioner who owns and operates 2 medical weight loss and wellness clinics in southeastern Wisconsin, told me in an email, "Personally, I had a killer 3-day headache. Had dreams of eating the tops off muffins. I don't even like muffins. And at one point, I nearly cut through 3 lanes of traffic to turn into a grocery store that carried my favorite chocolate chip scones. Just crazy." The lesson from anecdotal and clinical experience is that you can avoid the keto flu or reduce the symptoms by making sure you're eating sufficient fat and, more specifically, by replacing the sodium and water you're losing. Hence, eat salt, drink water is now advice that goes along with abstaining from carbohydrates, even if eat salt is another way LCHF ketogenic eating diverges from the conventional notion of a healthy diet. We've been told to avoid salt for the past 50 years because the nutritional authorities believe it's our high-salt diets that raise blood pressure and cause hypertension. This is another hypothesis that repeated experiments failed to confirm, but was accepted as true nonetheless. The likely explanation for why hypertension is associated with obesity and diabetes and metabolic syndrome, i.e., insulin resistance, why high blood pressure is one of the diagnostic criteria of metabolic syndrome, is that insulin and insulin resistance influence all these disease states. Reverse the insulin resistance and lower circulating insulin levels with LCHF ketogenic eating, and blood pressure will drop independent of salt consumption. Add salt and water back to avoid the symptoms of the keto flu, and blood pressure should still remain low and in a healthy range. In those who have hypertension, blood pressure clearly drops in clinical trials and clinical observation, despite the liberal use of salt in the diet. Finney and Volek, who have the most research experience in this field, plus the clinical experience garnered from Virta Health, recommend taking 4 to 5 grams a day of sodium, which is about 2 teaspoons of salt, or about twice what the average American consumes, typically in the processed, carb-rich, food-like products you won't be eating anymore. You can accomplish this by liberally salting your food to taste when eating and cooking. They also recommend magnesium supplementation, 300 to 500 milligrams a day initially, to help with muscle cramps, which are common with LCHF ketogenic eating and a sign of magnesium depletion. The loss of sodium is the primary reason physicians and dietitians who prescribe LCHF ketogenic eating suggest you drink a cup or two of broth or bouillon every day, made from the bones of meat or poultry. It's also a reason the 2015 New York Times article called bone broth a trend beverage, ranking with green juice and coconut water as the next magic potion in the quest for perfect health. A store-bought bouillon cube dissolved in hot water will do the trick. For those who are averse to drinking either, pickle juice is another sodium and electrolyte-rich solution. Two other possible withdrawal symptoms are also related to sodium depletion: postural hypotension and abnormal heart rhythm. Postural hypotension means that when you switch to LCHF ketogenic eating, your blood pressure can drop so low it doesn't adjust properly when you go from lying or sitting to standing. Dizziness, even passing out, can follow. Adding salt to your diet, drinking broth or bouillon, and ideally taking magnesium and potassium supplements should resolve both postural hypotension and any abnormal heart rhythm problems. You can now buy keto electrolyte supplements that combine all these minerals together in capsule form. Still, it's essential with both these conditions that you see your physician or cardiologist and make sure nothing more serious is going on. Most physicians also recommend a multivitamin with LCHF ketogenic eating to more or less cover any bases. Meat and eggs, though, are rich sources of essential vitamins and minerals, as are, of course, green leafy vegetables, which you're likely to eat copiously at least once a day. The fact that there's now a carnivore or zero-carb movement populated by Georgia Ead and others who seem to be healthy eating nothing but animal products strongly suggests that even green leafy vegetables may not be a necessary component of a healthy diet. These people and their zero-plant diets have incited considerable controversy, but their experience cannot be ignored. Another withdrawal symptom that appears to be relatively rare is the exacerbation of pre-existing gout. The excruciatingly painful symptoms of gout are caused by an excess of uric acid, and we store uric acid in our fat cells. The uric acid, too, is mobilized when insulin is low, and the excretion of uric acid in our urine uses the same kidney transport system as ketones. By competing with uric acid for renal tubular excretion, elevated blood ketones can promote hyperuricemia, is how this was described technically in the 1973 AHA critique of Atkins. Raised ketone levels and uric acid can accumulate in the circulation and lead to an outbreak of gout. Your physician can handle it as he or she would any gout outbreak. Eventually, circulating uric acid should return to a healthy level, and the gout, too, should be temporary. Experiencing any of these effects of carbohydrate withdrawal can feel like a reason to go back to eating starches and grains. But the symptoms should not last. The worst case is typically a couple of weeks of feeling like crap, as Patrick Rohal, a physician in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, told me. The solution is drink water and broth or bouillon, add salt, take magnesium supplements if necessary, and have patience. If the withdrawal symptoms don't abate, work with your physician to find out why. The one side effect of LCHF ketogenic eating that may be lasting is the one that is likely to make physicians most anxious. This is the effect on LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, as it's known in the conventional thinking. As discussed earlier, the common wisdom on a healthy diet is driven disproportionately by thinking about this single number, LDL cholesterol, and the unwarranted belief that it is a strong predictor of heart disease risk. Physicians learn in medical school that if LDL cholesterol is high, patients should be prescribed cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins. And of course, if their patients are eating diets with even moderate amounts of fat, they should stop doing so. The role of LDL cholesterol itself is still controversial. It can be controversial even to say that it's controversial. The relevant point is that something about eating fat-rich diets devoid of refined grains, sugars, and starches can increase LDL cholesterol and also drive up the number of LDL particles, which is a far better predictor of heart disease risk, as I've said. The data do not exist to say what proportion of people will experience elevated LDL, cholesterol, or particle number when they abstain from carbohydrates. But it is not a rare experience. It may be caused by the saturated fat content, although people eating paleo diets, which tend not to be saturated fat rich, dairy products and butter are not strictly paleo, have also been known to experience elevated levels of LDL. In the LCHF ketogenic eating world, these individuals are now known as hyper-responders. And the only reliable way to know if you are one is to abstain from eating carbohydrate-rich foods and find out. The more important questions are about whether this is harmful, and if so, how harmful. 1. Whether elevated LDL, cholesterol, or particle number means you are indeed at high risk of having a heart attack, even if you're abstaining from carbohydrates. 2. Whether that risk is significant. And 3. Whether the benefits of correcting obesity, diabetes, and all the metabolic disorders associated with them and with insulin resistance, hence metabolic syndrome, are offset by this increase in LDL cholesterol. It's not uncommon for physicians confronted with a patient who is following LCHF ketogenic eating and whose LDL cholesterol has gone up to talk that patient back to carbohydrates, to suggest, in effect, that they go back to eating potatoes and toast, as the Irish physician Daniel Murtaugh put it. Regardless of how much weight they might have lost and how significantly their blood pressure and blood sugar control might have improved, to several generations of physicians, keeping LDL cholesterol low is the be-all and end-all of heart health. Now, however, as physicians become more informed on the benefits of LCHF ketogenic eating, or at least more open-minded, this kind of knee-jerk conservative response is less common. At the moment, this question of trade-offs, lose weight, control blood sugar, and lower blood pressure, but elevate LDL in the process, is mired in controversy, and there are no long-term trials capable of resolving it. Informed physicians and researchers I've interviewed, and by informed, I mean those who have made an effort to understand both sides of the science, would argue that even in the worst-case scenario, in which LDL matters tremendously and it goes up, you can still bring it down, either by reducing the saturated fat you're consuming and replacing it with monounsaturated fat, exchanging butter for olive oil, for instance, or by using a relatively benign cholesterol-lowering drug, or both. Either way, you can still keep all the other health benefits that come with abstaining from carbohydrate-rich foods. If your physicians lean toward conventional thinking, they will advocate that you take a statin or other cholesterol-lowering drug if your LDL is elevated. If they don't, it might be because they assume, as I do, that possible side effects from the drug, one that you are expected to take daily for the rest of your life, are not worth whatever small benefit in longevity and health it might provide. Sarah Hallberg, who ran the trial for Virta Health at Indiana University on individuals with type 2 diabetes, says in their experience, hyper-responders, who are in nutritional ketosis, can lower their cholesterol with low-dose generic statins that cost dollars a month and seem otherwise benign. The last time I had my own blood lipids assessed, which was several years ago, my LDL cholesterol was elevated, as was the number of LDL particles in my bloodstream. They hadn't been a few years before that, but I have no other risk factors for heart disease. I chose to live with the high LDL and avoid taking a drug for the rest of my life that would have no short-term benefits on how I feel. It's an informed gamble. I don't like being dependent on a drug, particularly one that is supposedly preventing disease in the future, not addressing symptoms in the present. I'm willing to take the risk. I have physician friends who are highly informed on LCHF ketogenic eating, whose opinions I respect, and who have high LDLP, the particle numbers, and they do take low-dose statins. It's a judgment call you have to make that will depend on your sense of the evidence and your trust in your physician and whatever she or he recommends. 5. Adherence. Sustaining what you started in a world that makes it as difficult as possible. When I interviewed Jeff Stanley, a physician in Portland, Oregon, who now works with Virta Health, this is how he described the two primary challenges of prescribing LCHF ketogenic eating to his patients. The biggest challenge in getting people to succeed with this way of eating is getting them to try it. Once they try it, they'll experience the benefits. But then the second biggest challenge is getting them to stay with it. That's not because the benefits diminish or disappear. The patients are still losing weight without hunger and they feel healthy. But because, he said, life circumstances get in the way. Stanley says he has patients who abstain from carbohydrates, lose 15 pounds in a month, feel awesome, and then go on vacation, fall off, and have trouble getting back on. It's getting people to adopt it as a lifestyle that's important. People have to realize how much better they feel when they follow it, how much healthier they are, even if it means staying away from bread and cupcakes. One challenge of abstaining from carbohydrates that doesn't exist quite so intensely in quitting cigarettes, for example, is that the world conspires to make carbohydrate abstention as difficult as possible. You can't leave your house or turn on the television or get on the internet without being tempted to step off the wagon. Every holiday, every dinner out, every occasion with friends, every office get-together or even coffee break is an experience in having to say no to foods and treats you no longer eat, but your friends, family, and coworkers do. This experience will be driven by Pavlovian and cephalic phase responses, creating an urge to eat these foods that will then manifest as a rationale to eat them just this one time. When you quit smoking, your friends are very likely to help and encourage you along the way. If they smoke, they will try not to smoke around you. They won't say no if you ask them to take their cigarette outside, or at least your real friends won't. Many governments now help by enforcing rules against smoking in public spaces. Even if the stated rationale is to protect us from secondhand smoke, one consequence is to make it easier for smokers to quit. If you're abstaining from carbohydrates, though, you can't expect your friends not to order pasta if you eat at an Italian restaurant. They're not abstaining. Or say no to a dessert because you don't eat them. Or not to have a birthday cake at their birthday party. Few of us like being the person at the party who's saying no to the treats or the cake, but it's a skill we have to learn. When I asked Gary Kim, the physician who runs a chain of weight control clinics in the Los Angeles area, how he handles this challenge with his patients, he said that, having no control over it, he tries to demonize the food environment. I try to impart an us versus them mentality, he told me. People are conspiring to make us all fat, and we have to fight against it. We have to draw a line and not let them win. Losing this battle can be all too easy. One of the newspaper editors with whom I occasionally work described this phenomenon to me from her personal experience after she began LCHF ketogenic eating. One little slip and I'm back on carbs, she said. It's like I eat nothing, then have a grain of rice, and before I know it, I'm snarfing a donut. For many of us, the sensation of being on the edge of a slippery slope is ever present. This is why I personally find it easier to avoid sugar entirely than to try to eat it in moderation. Eating a few bites of a tasty dessert doesn't satisfy me, as it apparently does my wife. Rather, it creates a craving to eat it all and then some. Allowing myself to eat grains and starches in moderation also makes me hunger for more. Eating fat-rich foods helps extinguish binge behavior, as the Harvard pediatrician and nutritionist David Ludwig, author of Always Hungry, phrases it, as opposed to high-carb foods, which exacerbate it. The insulin dynamics discussed earlier help explain this phenomenon. Whatever the mechanism, if the goal is to avoid the kind of slip that leads from just this once or just one bite thinking to binge behavior and returning to a carb-rich, sugar-rich diet, then the same techniques that have been pioneered in the field of drug addiction for avoiding relapses should work in this scenario as well. These basic principles have evolved over decades, and addiction specialists believe they can work for anyone who's gotten clean and sober and wants to stay that way. Many of the principles are common sense, the kind of advice we would give our children if we were trying to keep them away from trouble. If we're trying to avoid a source of temptation, then we do our best to ensure it's out of sight, so it has a reasonable chance of being out of mind as well. Alcoholics who care about staying sober won't get a job in a bar or even walk down the alcohol aisle in a grocery store. The University of California, Berkeley addiction specialist Laura Schmidt told me when I interviewed her for a story about breaking an addiction to sugar. It's harder to avoid the carbohydrates that trigger our cravings because they're more ubiquitous in our environments, but we have to work to make that happen nonetheless. It will help, for starters, if you clean out your immediate environment, your kitchen and your cupboards, maybe even your desk drawers, so that it's free of the kind of carbohydrate-rich foods that tempt you. In 2013, David Weed, a psychologist in Fall River, Massachusetts, started a community health program that was awarded a Culture of Health Prize by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. His program included a 10-week course on LCHF ketogenic eating as part of an annual fitness challenge that attracted over 1,000 people each year. More than 100 people took the course over the 5 years he offered it. He said the ones who succeeded in his course, the ones who do it best, were those who literally did a carbohydrate clean out at home first. They then filled the refrigerator and freezer with the kinds of ketogenic-friendly foods they could cook and eat anytime. He told the participants that they had to respect the power of their environment. If you bring any food into the house, you're going to eat it, no matter whether you should or not. Don't think that you have the willpower to not consume carbohydrates that you bring home. The decision point has to be at the grocery store. You buy it, you wear it, he would say. This means you have to plan ahead for experiences and environments that are likely to weaken your resolve. Among the habits you have to form and reinforce is that of thinking ahead about what you can and cannot eat at office parties, in airports and on flights, on vacations, and at holiday meals. If you expect no LCHF ketogenic-friendly foods will be available, then plan to bring your own. If you were a vegan or a vegetarian, this is how you would approach such situations without a second thought. What can I eat? It's a natural question to ask yourself if what you eat is not necessarily what everyone else is likely to be eating. As Carrie Diulis told me, she won't get on a plane without a bag of macadamia nuts for her snack. If everyone else is eating and no LCHF ketogenic options are available, it helps to have one in your bag. This kind of thought and effort would go into any attempt to eat healthy. It simply requires a tighter, different focus. A greater implication of this power of the environment phenomenon is that you will more likely succeed if your family eats the same way you do, If you believe it's the healthiest way to eat, it will help if everyone at home agrees with you. A smoker is less likely to quit in a house full of smokers than in one in which all are quitting together or no others smoke. The same is true with LCHF ketogenic eating. People who are most successful in making the change, Weed said, are people who have a spouse who has also bought in. People with the biggest challenge are the ones who go home to a household full of carboholics, including kids and a spouse who insist on consuming high-carb meals. For many, it's just too difficult to manage, and they give up. Not because low-carb isn't working, but it's just too hard to stay with it in that kind of environment. Since your environment includes your social network, your friends and coworkers, it will help if they at least understand what you're doing and support it. Changing your social networks may be necessary as well. Beyond convincing your family and friends to be invested in your health, just as they would be if you were trying to quit smoking or alcohol, you may need to find an LCHF ketogenic eating group to join, online if necessary, so that you have a community that is supporting what you're doing, can help with questions or give advice, and can help you get back on the wagon when you fall off. It's the same reason alcoholics go to AA meetings, and people with other psychological and addiction issues go to group therapy sessions. I have never had anybody who tried this who didn't get good results, Weed told me. Not one. I have lots of people who get good results and then trip up. I always ask, why did you stop? I'll get a whole range of vague answers, but it largely comes down to the fact that people get little support for it. They do well if they're part of a group doing it. It's really an important part of the practice. People doing it in a group setting, they learn enough about it, and more important, they learn from their peers who are doing it too. This is all part of the process of going down the rabbit hole. Not only can you follow discussions on Twitter and Instagram on LCHF ketogenic eating, but you can follow websites like dietdoctor.com and diabetes.co.uk and join Facebook groups as well. Even those who eat no meat and animal products can join multiple Facebook groups of vegans who follow LCHF ketogenic eating, one of which has over 50,000 members as I write this, and thereby get support, advice, recipes, and help when needed. 6. Experimentation. Knowing which levers to pull when LCHF ketogenic eating does not sufficiently correct your health. LCHF ketogenic eating will work as if by magic for some of us, and not nearly as well for others. Some lose all their excess fat, and some not nearly as much as they'd like. Some resolve all their health problems, and some don't. Some get lean and healthy for a while, even for years, and then good health and a healthy weight become more elusive. Here's where individual variation is the critical factor. Some of this is clearly due to the action of hormones other than insulin on fat accumulation, though insulin remains the dominant link to what we eat. This is why men seem to have an easier time losing excess fat than women, and younger men and women will have an easier time than older ones. This observation was first made by the British physician Robert Kemp in a series of articles reporting on his clinical experience recommending LCHF ketogenic eating to over 1,400 overweight patients between 1956 and 1972. Many of the physicians I interviewed, although not all, agreed with it. Both testosterone and estrogen suppress fat formation. Testosterone above the waist, estrogen below it. As we get older and secrete less of these hormones, this inhibition is weakened, and our fat cells respond by getting fatter. Some of us will only be able to lose some of our excess fat. Others will fare much better. Insulin is the dominant hormone in fat accumulation, the one we can manipulate most obviously by changing our diet. But that may not be sufficient. In the course of my interviews, when I asked when and why LCHF ketogenic eating fails, why some people do not lose weight and some may even gain weight, many of those I spoke with had a story, if not about their patients, then about themselves. Carrie Diulis, for instance, said that she personally gains weight when she consumes too much butter. She doesn't have an off switch with butter, she said, so she's learned to avoid it. She also limits her access to ketogenic treats, as do I, such as low-carb cakes, cookies, and other desserts, and eats them only occasionally. It is just too easy, she says, to eat these foods to excess. A psychologist I interviewed, who has been running a series of clinical trials comparing LCHF ketogenic eating to more traditionally healthy diets and who requested anonymity, told me that she'll find herself craving carbohydrates if she eats as few as 4 strawberries a day. She therefore avoids strawberries, though she still eats other berries in season. I find that once I start eating nuts, I crave them, and so my best strategy and my healthiest weight come when I avoid them. Because I'm confident I have the skills and habits necessary to remain stable at a healthy weight for the long term, and because I'm very fond of nuts, I allow myself to fall on and off the nut wagon. These kinds of anecdotes speak to what these physicians describe as the need to find your triggers, not just the environmental triggers that endanger falling off the wagon, but the foods that inspire craving, that others might be able to eat with impunity, but that you apparently can't. While the basics of LCHF ketogenic eating are obvious, abstain from grains, starchy vegetables, and sugars, replace those calories with fat, individual variation is where the plateaus come in, and tweaking or massaging or fine-tuning what we eat and don't eat is necessary. Without the help of an experienced physician or dietitian, we have to examine our own diets and experiment with fixes to see what the problem might be and what works or doesn't. The experiments themselves should be at least several weeks long to give them time to work. The problems fall into 3 main categories, or 3 levers to consider pulling when LCHF ketogenic eating is no longer working or not working well enough. First, the obvious one, is determining if you're still eating too many carbohydrates. With patients who are weight stable yet swear they are religiously avoiding carbohydrates, physicians will have them keep a detailed food diary for 3 days. There are now apps that will make this relatively easy. So they can then see if that's true. This would also be a good time, physicians told me, to check if the patient is in measurable ketosis, not so much because ketosis is necessary to achieve health and a healthy weight, but because it will be a reliable sign of carbohydrate restriction. If the patient is in ketosis, the physician can have faith that he or she is indeed abstaining from carbohydrates and then move on, if necessary, to other possible explanations. It's important to examine how carbohydrates might be sneaking into your diet unnoticed. The apple a day that you still consider a healthy snack, the cornstarch used to thicken gravies, the accumulation of carbohydrates from nuts and nut butters. Sue Wolver told me about a patient with diabetes whose beautifully controlled blood sugar levels with LCHF ketogenic eating suddenly went awry. This patient had an upset stomach at one point and started popping Tums almost hourly. Tums is an antacid for acid reflux, and each tablet contains about 1.5 grams, 6 calories worth, of carbohydrates. This was enough to significantly worsen this woman's blood sugar. Once Wolver discovered what was happening and her patient discontinued the Tums, her blood sugar levels returned to normal. Another common problem, as Ken Berry puts it, is confusing the concept of less bad with good. I have patients, he told me, who eat sweet potatoes because they've heard they're not as bad as regular potatoes. Or they'll tell me they're not eating bread, but they're eating flour tortillas instead, or whole wheat bread instead of white bread. All this might be less bad, but it's not good enough. To be sure, a lot of this ultimately is common sense, or at least it's common sense in a world in which obesity is a hormonal/regulatory disorder, and the link between fat accumulation and what we eat runs through insulin and carbohydrates. If you're buying low-carbohydrate products in the supermarket, for instance, and you're not losing weight, these packaged foods might be the problem. Brian Sabowitz, an obesity medicine specialist in Spokane, described this to me as, you think you're on a low-carb diet, and you're not. Sabowitz said his favorite example was tuna salad, purchased as a prepared food in the supermarket. If you don't happen to look at the label, you think you're getting tuna and mayonnaise and maybe little celery chunks. When you look at the label, you see another ingredient is high fructose corn syrup. You're getting a bunch of sugar in your diet, and you think low carb didn't work because you did it and it failed. Few of the physicians I interviewed believed the concept of net carbs was a useful one. Net carbohydrates is a measure of only the carbohydrates that are digested and absorbed into the circulation. It doesn't include the carbohydrates that we don't digest and metabolize, the fiber. Net carbs can be useful to ensure you're staying under some predetermined maximum of carb consumption every day, say the 50 grams often set as a limit for ketogenic diets. But if your weight loss has stalled while you still have excessive body fat, then it might be a good idea to trust your body rather than the manufacturer's determination of net carbs. The goal is more or less rigid abstinence, and your body will tell you if you're erring on the side of being too liberal. Second, too much fat in the diet has also ironically become a possible reason for weight loss to stall. Now that LCHF ketogenic diets have moved toward the mainstream, they've been accompanied by new ways to infuse the body with fat that might be physiologically unnatural. Until recently, humans rarely, if ever, had the opportunity to drink fat without at least some protein or carbohydrates to go with it. Now we do. Bulletproof coffee, for instance, popularized by the Silicon Valley entrepreneur Dave Asprey, is a mixture of coffee, butter or ghee, and MCT oil, typically derived from coconut oil. Because the MCT, medium-chain triglycerides, are metabolized primarily in the liver, they can increase the synthesis of ketones even with some carbohydrates in the diet. This is why bulletproof coffee may provide an energy boost beyond that of the caffeine in the coffee alone, but it also floods the body with fat, or at least trickles it in like an intravenous infusion over the course of hours. Some of us may be fine with that. Some of us may burn the fat we're eating, or in this case drinking, and still have excess fat that remains stored in our fat tissue at the end of the day. I can eat a pound of coconut oil right now, Ted Naiman, a Seattle physician who has been advocating LCHF ketogenic eating for almost 20 years, told me. And I will be in the deepest ketosis you've ever seen, and I won't lose any weight. I will be burning fat, but it's the fat I ate, not the fat I stored. Whether your body burns or stores these fat infusions can also change with time. What we can tolerate during weight loss may be different from what we can tolerate once we're weight stable. The idea that we can eat as much fat as we want without storing some as excess may be true for some of us, but not for all. Third, you may be consuming too much protein. It's a common tendency, as we discussed earlier, to try to compromise between health paradigms by eating a low-carbohydrate diet that is also a low-fat diet. This is what many physicians used to prescribe for obesity pre-1970s because they thought the body needs protein but can live without the calories from both carbohydrates and added fats. The result, notwithstanding the unsatisfying meals, is calorie restriction, or a high proportion of protein in what you're eating. The amino acids in the protein can elevate insulin in response, which might be enough to stimulate fat accumulation and hunger, including cravings and binge behavior. The solution is to add more fat, butter or olive oil on the vegetables, chicken thighs with the skin on instead of chicken breasts without, fatty cuts of meat and fatty fish instead of lean. The use of artificial sweeteners may be another reason LCHF ketogenic eating can work poorly. Most of the physicians and dietitians I interviewed think of these sweeteners, as I do, as a useful crutch while transitioning to LCHF ketogenic eating and breaking a sugar addiction, the methadone of sugar, as Sue Wolver calls them. Artificial sweeteners from natural sources, stevia, for instance, which comes from a shrub in Central America, or monk fruit, may be more benign than the sweeteners that were invented or discovered in a chemistry lab in modern times. But that's an assumption for which we have no meaningful experimental evidence. Saccharin, which was first discovered in coal tar derivatives, has been used as a sweetener since the 1890s. It's 300 to 500 times as sweet as sugar, which means obtaining the equivalent sweetness requires only 1/300 to 1/500 the dose. It also passes through the body without being metabolized, a good thing. The evidence that these artificial sweeteners are harmful in and of themselves is not compelling to me. Some evidence exists, though, that they may fool our bodies into thinking we're consuming sugars, and respond in a way that might interfere with fat metabolism and the use of our stored fat for fuel. It might do so just by making us hungrier and even hungrier for carbohydrates. When weight loss stalls and you still have significant excess fat to lose, common sense is required. Ask yourself what you're eating or drinking that might be interfering with fat metabolism. If you're using an artificial sweetener, that's an obvious suspect. It makes sense to see what happens when you avoid it. Give it up for a few weeks. The harder that may seem to you, the more likely it is that giving it up is a good idea. If it makes a difference in how your body responds to LCHF ketogenic eating, if you start getting leaner again, then you know artificial sweeteners trigger a response in your body that is problematic. Your sweetener of choice may be fine for some, but not for you. You can also add it back into your diet to see if weight loss stalls again. If it does, then it's telling you that your body can't tolerate these sweeteners. Common sense also dictates that you break yourself of your craving or need for sweets. Ideally, when you shift to LCHF ketogenic eating, you'll find pleasure in food from the savory elements, the salt and the fat. Have patience, though, as these changes in taste and preference can take time. Alcohol presents a similar issue, in which common sense is a good mediator. If you're maintaining significant excess fat on LCHF ketogenic eating, your alcohol intake might be the problem. Alcohol can be thought of as a fourth macronutrient. Its caloric density, 7 calories per ounce, is between that of carbohydrates and protein, 4 grams, and fat, 9 grams. Drinking cocktails with sugary sodas, tonic water, or sugar-rich alcohols, for example, brandy, will likely be fattening. The calories in beer are from carbohydrates, maltose, as well as alcohol. Even the carbohydrate content in low-carb beers might be enough to put you over the insulin threshold. Some of us will be able to tolerate it. Some of us won't. Red wine is better than white wine because it has fewer calories and less sugar. But multiple glasses of red wine daily or even weekly might derail weight loss. This is clear from anecdotal and clinical experience. Alcohol is metabolized in liver cells much like the fructose from sugar, and it can cause similar problems, particularly fatty liver. The liver will burn alcohol and generate energy in doing so, and the heart muscle and kidney will burn the metabolic byproduct of that process, acetate. If they're doing that, though, they're not using fat for fuel, and it may be accumulating. If you don't find out how your metabolism runs without the alcohol, you'll never know if it's worth the trade-off. There's a lot to be said for living well, however we define it. But if you're drinking alcohol of any kind while embracing LCHF ketogenic eating, and you're still maintaining excessive fat and insulin resistance, experimenting for a month or two without the alcohol seems worthwhile. If the prospect of going a month or two without alcohol seems intolerable, as with the artificial sweeteners, practicing abstinence may be more important than you think. You might also try exercise, but not for the purpose of burning calories. As with everything in this world that involves fat and fuel metabolism, we have to change our perspective. From this viewpoint, physical activity is the kind of thing you want to do when you're metabolically flexible, insulin sensitive, and burning your own fat. It's not an effective way to force your body to reduce your fat stores. Burning off calories through exercise is likely to make you hungry, as we discussed. It's unlikely to make you significantly leaner. One possibility, though, is that building muscle can help, which implies resistance training, weights, rather than burning calories through cardio. A few clinical trials have suggested that resistance training augments weight loss with LCHF ketogenic eating. A bout of resistance training, or cardio, will deplete your glycogen stores and make you more insulin sensitive while your cells try to replace the lost glycogen. If you're doing LCHF ketogenic eating, this increase in insulin sensitivity may be meaningful. The Seattle physician Ted Naiman says he has seen some of his patients, older women who are very sedentary and massively stalled out, return to losing excess fat by going to the gym and doing resistance training. It's worth a try. Otherwise, exercise simply because it makes you feel good, if it does. That's reason enough. One of the experiments I tried, beginning in August 2017, was intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating, TRE. The simplest way to put it in my case is that I stopped eating breakfast. All my meals, including snacks, now fell between lunch, around 1 p.m., and dinner, which typically ended by 8 p.m. The technical definitions of intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating overlap, and this can get confusing. Both terms can refer to eating only two meals a day, as I did, and no snacking after the second one, either breakfast and lunch, and then skipping post-lunch snacks and dinner, or eating lunch and dinner only, and then avoiding after-dinner snacks and skipping breakfast. Hence the term time-restricted eating refers to the window of time during the day in which you are eating, say 7 hours from lunch to the end of dinner, in my case. Intermittent fasting refers to the time you're not eating, the 17 hours, in my case, between dinner and lunch the next day. With either term, you're extending the duration of time in which you have to rely on your fat stores for fuel. You're prolonging the amount of time you're under the insulin threshold, and fat is being mobilized and oxidized. People who embrace it, under either name, as I did, say they find it easy to skip one meal a day if they're already doing LCHF ketogenic eating, although it may take a few days to get used to it. In other words, they feel no additional hunger by not eating breakfast or dinner. I was initially skeptical about intermittent fasting / TRE, assuming that it was most likely a passing fad. A few years from now, I thought we'll all be saying, remember back around 2018 when everybody was fasting, skipping meals, going days without eating? Then I had 3 days of travel, all morning flights, which presented an easy opportunity to try it. All I had to do was say no to airplane food, which is never that difficult. By the time I returned home, not eating breakfast was surprisingly easy. Over the next few months, I lost a dozen pounds that I didn't think I needed to lose, and I did so without hunger. I kept it up and still do because I feel better when I don't eat breakfast. I have more energy and mental clarity. I'm no longer hungry in the morning. And having my first meal of the day early in the afternoon feels normal to me now. I don't think of what I'm doing as particularly faddish. I'm just not a breakfast person anymore, and that's how I talk about it. Nutrition researchers are now doing clinical trials testing the benefits of intermittent fasting / TRE, typically comparing it with other means of reducing calories. The researchers, in other words, assume fasting works because we eat less during those periods, as we do, and that's why we lose weight. As noted, it also prolongs the period that our fat cells are below the insulin threshold, experiencing the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency, and therefore mobilizing fat. Either way, it's a reasonable assumption that intermittent fasting / TRE has become common because for many people it works, as it did for me. It makes them leaner and healthier, and does so without hunger. It's not a religion, as Carrie Diulis would say. It's about how we feel. You don't need a clinical trial to tell you if intermittent fasting / TRE works for you. You can try it and find out. The term intermittent fasting can also be used to refer to the 5-2 diet plan, popularized by the British physician-turned-television journalist Michael Mosley, in which for 2 days a week, you restrict your calories to under 800 a day and your carbohydrates to under 400. It can also imply fasting regularly for days or a week or more, as popularized by the Toronto physician and kidney specialist Jason Fung. Many of the Canadian physicians I interviewed for this book credited Fung's 2016 book, The Obesity Code, with introducing them to LCHF ketogenic eating. When I interviewed Fung, he told me that many of his patients had obesity and/or diabetes, and this was the reason for their kidney problems. Around 2012, he started recommending LCHF ketogenic eating, but with little success in his practice. A significant proportion of his patients were immigrants from the Philippines or Southeast Asia, and he had trouble communicating the idea to them, he said, let alone convincing them that they should no longer eat rice or noodles, the staples of their diet. He started thinking about other ways they might lower their insulin levels without pharmaceutical therapy, and he hit on fasting. What's wrong with this idea of intermittent fasting, or even extended fasting, for 7 days? Fung said. I started looking into it, and there's really nothing wrong. People have been doing it for thousands of years, and it has the same ultimate goal of LCHF ketogenic diets, which is that it drives insulin low for extended periods of time. Everything is going to be maximally minimized. I read all the literature. There's nothing there that tells me people can't do it. I'm not talking about thin people going without food for 40 days. I'm talking about 300-pound people going 24 hours without food. Feng had an easier time, he said, convincing his patients to fast regularly, anywhere from 24 hours, dinner to dinner, two or three times a week, as he now does himself, to a week or more for his heaviest patients. He still tries to get his patients on a relatively low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet, but then he adds fasting as well. He told me stories of patients who had been on 150 units of insulin a day, high doses, with severe type 2 diabetes, getting off their insulin within 2 months. As for his track record, he said he can convince about half his patients to try it, and most of them get healthier. I treat very severe type 2 diabetes, he said, so the alternative is 0% get better. In that context, he said, his success rate is pretty good. Intermittent fasting, as a common tool for weight control, has now run far ahead of the research that could establish its safety beyond all reasonable doubt. It's another informed gamble. Like the physicians who now prescribe fasting, the few researchers studying it agree that fasts of up to a day regularly can be beneficial and carry little risk. Many of them do it themselves. At a June 2018 meeting in Zurich of researchers and physicians studying LCHF ketogenic eating for type 2 diabetes, hosted by the reinsurance company Swiss Re, I took a poll of the 50 in attendance. More than 40 were skipping at least one meal a day. If you fast for longer than 24 hours, though, the risks of fasting gradually increase, and you have to hope that they don't outweigh the benefits. Jason Fung, who has had as much clinical experience on this issue as anyone, believes longer fasts are effective methods to resolve obesity and type 2 diabetes. Steve Finney and Jeff Volek of Virta Health, both informed researchers, are less sanguine. They worry specifically about loss of lean mass, muscle rather than fat, when fasting for longer than a day or two, or full day fasting more than once or twice a week. For those with diabetes, longer fasts require that medications be adjusted for times without food and then readjusted when the fast ends. Improper medication management carries significant health risks, as they put it. Prescription drug use can also stall weight loss with LCHF ketogenic eating, and that's another matter that will require the assistance of an informed physician. Certain drugs are known to promote weight gain, and others might. The most obvious are drugs for diabetes, insulin injections, for instance. But if you're avoiding carbohydrates, you'll minimize your need for these drugs. Some anti-anxiety medications and antidepressants can cause weight gain and so inhibit weight loss. Epilepsy drugs can cause weight gain. Some blood pressure medications will do it, in particular the family known as beta blockers, as will some contraceptives and even antihistamines for allergies. You have to look at the benefits and risks of stopping medications or changing them, as Charles Cavo told me. Despite his experience now with 15,000 patients, he still called the process of weaning off prescription drugs a can of worms. For a physician like Cavo, prescribing LCHF ketogenic eating may also require a discussion with the doctor who originally prescribed the medications and an understanding on that physician's part of the efficacy and philosophy of LCHF ketogenic eating. All this has to be considered seriously and treated seriously if the goal is to achieve and maintain a healthy body weight and get as healthy as possible.